Hello, I'm Stephen M. Strakowski. I am the chair of psychiatry at the University of Texas in Austin and the New Dell Medical School. Thank you all for tuning into this webcast. I really do appreciate the people who watch these webcasts regularly and send in your comments, and please continue to do so. Today I want to talk about bipolar disorder in the elderly, probably more technically correct, mania in the elderly. There have been a couple of recent papers that came out that address this topic where we really just don't know enough. One was by Martha Sajadovic. She's at Case Western, and it was in Bipolar Disorders, the journal. And the other is by Tamara Katz, and she's at McLean. And it was in Current Treatment Options in Psychiatry. Both those references you can see on the bottom of the slides that are attached to this webcast. So those are useful resources. So to start with, as most of you know, and we've talked about in other webcasts, bipolar disorder is typically an illness of young people. The mean age of onset is usually in the late teens to perhaps early 20s, and it's fairly unusual to occur after about 35. In the recent STEP BD program, the two-thirds of cases had started by age 18, for example. And in those young people, it's got high rates of suicide that makes it one of the more lethal of psychiatric disorders. However, it does happen, mania does occur in people over 50, which is now considered the elderly population in these studies, which is a struggle for me being 55, and I continue through vanity to refuse to join AARP, for example. But nonetheless, that's the agreed upon age, although there's some debate between 50 and 60, but at some level that becomes academic. Because after 35 it's unusual to start new, these 50-year-old bipolar folks present some interesting and different challenges. When you're presenting with mania after 50, there's kind of two ways to think about it. One is that these are bipolar folks who had a typical age at onset and have managed to successfully navigate life to continue to be around at 50, given that that bipolar disorder is associated with a younger age at death by about 10 years. This sometimes is no small feat. The second are people who, after 50, develop a first manic episode, and those are probably a very different group than the bipolar disorder folks who've just managed to live this long. About 5% of new bipolar cases occur in this older age group. And in general, when you are faced with a patient like this, your assumption should be that this is a so-called secondary mania, not from bipolar disorder, the genetic illness per se, but is more likely to have a medical cause. And so the first line of business with someone with a new onset of mania in this age group is to work very diligently to try to identify causes. Now, there are a number of potential causes, and at some level, virtually anything that can affect the brain has some potential risk to create mania, although, as we've talked in previous webcasts, depression is far more likely to be the induced mood episode. Nonetheless, secondary mania has been associated with various types of brain injury, from trauma to stroke, subarachnoid bleeds or other hemorrhages. Usually they're injuries that occur within ventral prefrontal networks that disrupt the networks that are thought to underlie bipolar disorder. There are some brain diseases like multiple sclerosis or epilepsy, or even Huntington's if it happens to be someone whose symptoms have started somewhat later to creep into this age group. Again, relatively rare. Normal pressure hydrocephalus, and then a new manic episode may be the first symptoms or presentation of someone with an evolving dementia. The symptoms with delirium can often look like mania, and those two are sometimes confused, although in the delirious case there is a loss of sensorium and understanding kind of where you are. Unfortunately, mania can produce a delirium, and so that becomes a very important differential, as it can. Delirium can, of course, be lethal. There are systemic diseases like Cushing's syndrome, hyperthyroidism, vitamin 12 deficiencies, hemodialysis can all produce and have been reported to produce manic episodes. And then infectious diseases, any of the viruses that cross into the brain and cause encephalitis or other related conditions, HIV are things you have to think about. In the old days, we always worried a lot about neurosyphilis, which has become less common, but periodically rebounds and becomes more common in the population again. Finally, perhaps the most important thing to think about in an older person who's presenting with manic symptoms is to really take a close look at all the medications they're on. Again, there's some obvious ones like stimulants or perhaps antidepressants or steroids that are relatively commonly identified as causing these types of symptoms. But virtually, again, anything that can cross the blood-brain barrier should at least be considered. And often the first intervention is to just simplify the medication regimen. One of the challenges as we get older is medications we tolerated at 50, we may not tolerate at 75 because our metabolism is no longer as efficient, and so a level may become toxic. Additionally, if someone has a history of bipolar disorder and a new manic episode, you can't simply assume that some of these causes aren't part of it as well. One of the difficult parts of taking care of people with bipolar disorder is they develop over time, like all of us as we age, an accumulation of medical problems, but unfortunately having bipolar disorder increases the risk of almost every major medical illness. So cardiovascular disease, cerebrovascular disease, cancers, metabolic diseases like diabetes, and there's some evidence that dementia may be more likely with a history of bipolar disorder. So all of those also accumulate in an older person with a typical onset of bipolar illness and may precipitate a new manic or depressive episode later in life, despite, for example, having been stabilized for many, many years. And so whenever working with people in the older age group, for manic symptoms or in a bipolar person, manic or depressive symptoms, it's always very important to spend extra time ruling out potential medical either precipitants of someone who has bipolar disorder or a new cause of mania. So the treatment then, unfortunately, despite the fact that our population is aging and more people with bipolar disorder are fortunately making it into this age group, and there are just more older people to develop secondary mania, we still really don't know a lot about treatment differences from younger adults. And so generally speaking, paradigms we use to treat younger adults are just translated into older patients. For example, there's very little understood about, for example, specific cognitive therapies that you might use for depressed older bipolar folks that take into account the circumstances of aging, and as you get into your 70s and 80s, of all the challenges that life throws at you, including losing family and friends who start dying because they're also aging with you. The second piece I already kind of alluded to is that as you age, your ability to tolerate a medicine that you might have been on for 20 years may decline, and so either requires changing in doses or changing in medication approaches. There's the old adage that all of us learned in residency about starting low and going slow, and that really does apply in these older patients. And so I typically will find the lowest preparation available, ideally at least half the typical adult starting dose, and if necessary, if it's possible, we may cut even the lowest dose in half if there's not urgency to get a condition managed. Again, unfortunately, there just aren't a lot of trials, and so we don't have good data for alternative approaches. So today, we know that just because of their longevity, and they've been around a long time, both lithium and divalproex appear to be generally well-tolerated and generally effective in older age group. Both of these drugs have fairly simple metabolic profiles, which helps them as you have to manage interactions with a lot of other medications in people who are accumulating medical illnesses. Lithium, of course, for example, is fully managed by the kidney, and so there's relatively fewer drugs that interact with kidney metabolism, with renal metabolism, to become a problem. Nonetheless, it's something that needs to be attended to. There may be a slight advantage to lithium over other treatments in this age group for that reason. Additionally, the blood levels in lithium are meaningful, and so that helps as people age to monitor dosing. Lamotrigine has one positive augmentation trial, again was very well tolerated and serves a useful second addition or may have even a primary role in older people depending on tolerance. Electroconvulsive therapy moves up most paradigms in older folks just because paradoxically, despite all the stigma, it's often better tolerated and is useful for treating both phases of bipolar illness. It may have a utility in someone with an underlying medical problem where drugs may not be tolerable, and so it's something to at least keep in mind and probably lower your threshold of using it compared to someone who's a lot younger. Be careful with carbamazepine. It's just got so many drug-drug interactions, and again, older folks have tended to accumulate medications, and so I generally don't recommend it as a first line for older patients, although it may be something to consider. And again, someone who maybe has been on it for years suddenly will start having interactions because of metabolic changes, and so just something to monitor. Similarly, with benzodiazepines can cause a lot of problems, and particularly the really elderly folks in 70s and 80-year-old folks with sedation and falls and other issues, and so should really be managed and used very carefully. The atypical antipsychotics are, of course, widely used in younger people, but unfortunately there's a black box class warning against elderly folks with dementia, as there's evidence of increased risk of sudden death. And there's also possible evidence of increased risk of cerebrovascular accidents. And so it's something, again, in the younger 50-year-old folks may be less of a concern, but as we start approaching the 70s and 80s, particularly with symptoms of dementia, we want to be very, very thoughtful about whether an atypical is our best choice. There's probably not a lot of difference among them, at least we don't know that so far, for elderly bipolar people or secondary mania, and so it becomes a choice on side effect profiles versus the various accumulated medical illnesses the patient may have and try to identify the ones that are least likely to be a problem. For example, if someone has cardiac arrhythmias or conduction problems, ziprasidone is not the best choice. If someone's diabetic and has obesity issues, then similarly olanzapine is probably not the best choice. And so use those kind of side effect profiles, assuming that in general efficacy is probably not dissimilar. There have been a couple of post hoc analyses of randomized clinical trials of lurasidone and quetiapine where the elderly patients were taken out and examined separately, and they both were successful and tolerated, and so those are, again, suggesting as a class the atypicals are probably can be used with all the caveats that we've just discussed. And so with those things in mind, it's clear what we really need is more work in this area, particularly with an aging population. My hope from this webcast, if nothing else, is some of you younger psychiatrists who may be watching this will think about this as a research career, because it just hasn't been well populated by us to understand how we manage these folks separately. So hopefully that will occur. I encourage people to think about it, and we'll hope, and again, the two papers I mentioned at the beginning, I think, are great starts for people who are interested in this and thinking about this more. Again, I want to thank you for watching this webcast and the others. We're always looking for good topic suggestions, so if any of you want to write in as you respond to different webcasts and suggest other things you'd like us to discuss, that would be wonderful. And thank you very much.